Hey there, this is Mark Scarborough, and this is the podcast Walking with Dante, a podcast that is at a very short nine lines of Canto 12 of Purgatorio, the second canticle of Dante's masterwork comedy. We've been walking through comedy for a very long time, and we have a lot of road to go ahead of us. So why are we going so slowly? Because this is the final, what I want to say, fillip of meaning, the final little bit to all of those reliefs carved in the roadbed of the Terrace of Pride. And I want to talk a little bit about this because it makes an interesting move as the finale or the coda to those reliefs. An interesting move that seems to me very human and one which blows apart a lot of what we've been talking about all along. This is my English translation of Purgatorio Canto 12, lines 64 through 72. You can find it on my website, markscarborough.com or walkingwithdante.com. You can print it off. You can make your own notes on it, or you can continue the conversation with me there. Let us get right to it. The end of the long sequence of the reliefs carved into the roadbed of the Terrace of Pride on Mount Purgatory. What master of the brush and stylus could have fabricated the chiaroscuro and tracings that would astonish even a discriminating genius? The dead seemed dead, the living, living. Somebody who saw the actual events saw them no better than I did with my head bent down, treading on top of them. Now grow arrogant and walk with your faces up, you sons of Eve. Don't lower your vision to pay attention to your own evil path. In this episode ahead, what I'd like to do is talk about a couple little translation things in the passage. I want to then get to that bit about the evil path. Don't lower your vision to your own evil path, because it does remind us of what we're actually reading. And then I want to come out to this larger question of the veracity of comedy and how this actually helps us put it in a more human context. So let's get started. The first thing I want to say is that I have made a translation decision that isn't actually correct. I translated the word for shadows or shading as chiaroscuro. This word is a little bit too forward in time from what Dante means. He does mean this. He means, in fact, the shadings that create realism inside of these carvings. But my word for this pen technique on paper, this crosshatch technique of shading, is a little out of place. It's a little anachronistic here. But I think it's important to call attention to it because it shows us that Dante is thinking about this way of creating shadows for realism. I think that's really important to the larger passage, since especially he makes it all turn on the notion of genius, that these shadows, or as I said, chiaroscuro and tracings, would astonish even a discriminating genius, a learned talent. Is that Dante? Are they here in such a way that they even astonish Dante in some way? I mean, it goes on and says, the dead seem dead and the living living. And this is a really interesting passage because if I had to translate it actually, it's actually the dead dead and the living seemed living. I had to move the verb up to the first bit, the dead seemed dead. The seemed actually occurs back with the living in the sequence of words. I had to do that so it would make better sense to us, but that seemed is really important. It's not that the dead are dead and the living are living. It's the seemed, and yet that seemed translates into realer than real. Somebody who saw the actual events saw them no better than I did. There's that I with my head bent down treading on top of them, and it's that I that makes us go back to talent or genius. Is Dante saying that this stuff even surprises him? If so, his ego knows no bounds. Nonetheless, he's making a claim about these carvings that they are so real that they can actually stand in for the actual events themselves. We need only think about the ways that carvings and paintings of saints will eventually become in church doctrine, the localization of the saints or Mary or Jesus's presence. We need only think of the way presence is becoming increasingly important to the understanding of reality in the West. It becomes focal to how we think about reality, that is, its presence. I know that sounds odd because it's so accepted and it's becoming more accepted in Dante's day. All that's sitting under this passage, but then it moves off into a direction that we should really follow. It ends with, "Now grow arrogant and walk with your faces up, your heads held up, your foreheads high, you sons of Eve." So it returns to a sense of humanity's creation. That is, we are actually humans walking this very road. And I think that that return to us, and yes, Dante does say sons, but we'll give it to Dante in his vaguely misogynistic medieval self. He means humans as all, but okay, sons. You sons of Eve, don't lower your vision to pay attention to your own evil path. And this is a really crucial twist. This makes the whole thing an allegory. If we think about it, what's happening here is he's saying that we're all walking a road with exemplars of pride under our feet, but we're also proud we can't even look down at it. And this reminds us, and it's really important to remind us, that this poem that we're reading is at its heart an allegory. It is at its heart a way in which you make meaning through the creation of an alternate reality that shows this one, we'll get more into that in a moment, and that this reality that you're creating shows larger concepts than even itself. But it's important to return to this notion of an allegory here because we have been fighting this notion of Dante turning the poem into an actual historical document. He actually went there. He actually saw these things. You should know that there's a long debate in Dante scholarship about whether this is actually happening or it's a dream vision. Or in modern critics' terminology, it's that it's kind of a halfway place. It's both a dream vision and the chronology of an actual journey, and they both kind of happen simultaneously or overlaid on top of each other, and Dante doesn't sort it out enough for us to see. Part of our problem in seeing this as a historical reality, and part of our fighting with the veracity of this and the realism claims of art, and that the art of God is realer than real, all of this fighting around verisimilitude is, of course, our rationalistic selves, our neoclassical, neo-rational selves, trying to come to terms with a medieval poem. But this is a nice moment in which we have to remember that we're dealing with a medieval text, and the medieval text is seeing reality allegorically. It is a symbol for higher truths, and it's also seeing it anagogically. That is, the journey is actually the soul's ascent. So Dante's journey from Inferno through Purgatorio and up through Paradiso models what the soul must do to find its ultimate, mature, fulfilled, engaged, and we would say sanctified, in Dante's terminology, sanctified state. In the same way that the Aeneid was read anagogically as the soul's progress from chaos to order or from defeat to triumph, Dante's poem can be read anagogically as well as allegorically. And this bit in which the whole thing turns back to you and me and says, hey, you're walking a path littered with your own evil, or in this case, exemplars of evil, you're walking this very path. This reminds us that for all of our big highfalutin, high critical talk about verisimilitude and veracity and truth claims and all of this that's happening and is art realer than real and is art realer than history and all this stuff that we're fighting in a rationalist context is a little bit out of place in Dante, because for Dante, this is fundamentally an allegorical and anagogical poem. I want to talk about something that I've been fighting lately in all of this talk. We've been talking about Dante proving his journey. He's casting his shadow. The art is realer than reality. So this journey is realer than a real journey. We've been fighting all of these claims over and over again. But we as a species, humans as a species, we do this most odd thing. We make up stories in order to teach moral lessons or tell the truth. And just step back from that a minute. We fabricate stories. And out of these stories, let's say Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. We create these stories, and out of these stories, we expect to teach moral truths about how women and men should behave toward one another, to use Austen's example. We use these stories to elucidate human behavior and to further enhance our understanding of our own morality and moral place. In Austen's case, the foundation of social relations through marriage. In so doing, we make up stories. Just think about this for a second. If you came upon us as a species and you didn't know anything about us, say you came from another planet and you didn't know anything about us, and you discovered that here's this species that tells lies, makes up stories in order to discover the truth. Not only that, the stories that they make up form the basis of how they understand their own lives. So the story that Dante is making up in terms of journeying across the afterlife actually is meant to, channel, to shape, to form, to mold my understanding of my own life, that I am constantly walking on the exemplars of pride, that I am walking down a prideful path. Now, this causes a little bit of a problem in Purgatorio, and this passage is a little bit, and dare I say this, a little bit sloppy, because although it makes the allegorical claim that we're walking a proud path and don't recognize it, you certainly wouldn't claim that the terrace of pride in purgatory is a prideful path, because this is where the penitents are paying the debt of their pride. They're not on a prideful path. They're on a pride-ridding path. Dante, in pushing the allegory here, has gone to a little bit of a sloppy place. It's not quite as demarcated as I would like it to be. But still, his move is incredibly human, to figure out the story and to use that story, what is totally made up. I mean, especially Purgatorio. Dante doesn't... Purgatory hasn't been around long enough for Dante to have a defined notion of what purgatory is. So he's making this up in order to teach moral truths, which is what you and I do all the time. It's how we live our lives. And we fool ourselves into thinking that stories do not school us and channel us and create us. I'm teaching right now a Faulkner seminar at a local library for 6 weeks, and we're in the middle of The Wild Palms. One of the things that happens in The Wild Palms is there are two novels that run contemporaneously on top of each other in this insane novel, The Wild Palms. And what Faulkner does is he blends these two stories, but they're disconnected temporally. They're only connected vaguely thematically. They happen 10 years apart. They're running on top of each other contemporaneously. It's a really interesting novel. One of the things the novel is about is the way that stories alter your perception of reality. And so one of the figures in the novel The Wild Palms is a convict. And the reason he committed the crimes he did is because he read cheap detective novels and dime store novels in Faulkner's day in the 30s and 40s. He read dime store cheap detective novels And he became in some way imbued with their spirit as he went out and committed a crime. And the other story in it is basically about a man who becomes a porn writer. He writes really bodice ripper stories in the 30s for magazines, and he essentially tries to live his life as one of those stories, except it won't work for various reasons. And the whole novel is about the way that stories eventually deceive us. And that is true, and we all know that stories shape our reality and deceive us. And yet, we are a narrative species. We can't not tell stories. We know the truth about them. They're deceptive. And yet we can't let go of them because they're our way to the truth. Just think about that paradox. We exist in this world in which we must tell something as a story, and then we must use that in order to elucidate moral or even physical truths about ourselves or the world around us. And sometimes we get uncomfortable with that and we start to make historicity claims for the story or veracity claims for the story. Well, you know, such and such really did happen. I'm not just telling a saint's legend because I got a bone of a saint right here. We're trying to take that story, which is the human condition of narrative, and we're trying to settle it into the physical world. But we know that we can't do that. Like Dante, we have to tell a story in order to get to a moral truth. One more time, the coda to the Reliefs in the Roadbed of the Terrace of Pride, Purgatorio, Canto 12, lines 64 through 72. What master of the brush and stylus could have fabricated the chiaroscuro and tracings that would astonish even a discriminating genius? The dead seemed dead, the living. Somebody who saw the actual events saw them no better than I did, with my head bent down, treading on top of them. Now grow arrogant and walk with your faces up, you sons of Eve. Don't lower your vision to pay attention to your own evil path. Thanks so much for being on this fictional journey with me. It's not so fictional because we're doing it, but it's also not so fictional because it's attempting to tell the truth of the human condition as Dante understands it. And it's not so fictional because apparently Dante can see and even create art that is realer than real. You don't need to have experienced the beheading of Holofernes. All you have to do is see a relief. I hope that you will subscribe to this podcast. I hope you'll rate it and like it and do those things. And mostly, I hope you'll just keep walking with me, because this is fascinating stuff and very central to our human condition. I'm Mark Scarborough. I'll see you on the walk ahead.